How important do you feel books like The Empire and the Crescent are?
I think that this is a very important book because it presents views from both sides of the divide, if you will, in terms of Western writers who are very politically astute and also Muslim writers who are looking at the religion from a wider perspective. And I think Muslims need to hear a lot of what the Westerners are saying, because by reading their views and perusing their take on things, they're able to see that there are a lot of very sincere non-Muslims who understand what Muslims are experiencing, who understand the nature of the political arrangements that at least at this juncture in history seem to be coming down extremely hard on the Muslim people and the Muslim world. And so it helps them to not look at the West as sort of a monolithic entity, but to understand that there are different voices and that there are a lot of voices that are potential allies. And on the other hand, I think the non-Muslims can benefit by seeing there are Muslim voices out there who aren't saying, off of your head, you infidel, but are trying to take a more enlightened view of things and to really look at Islamic teachings to articulate those views that are very much compatible with living productively in a pluralistic society.
You've chosen a very specific subject for your contribution to the book. You make the case that in the traditional understanding of Islam, holy war was never considered to be a perpetual state. Do you feel that this is a quite specific misunderstanding many people have?
No, I think it's a misunderstanding some Muslims have. But really, I'm trying to target a Western audience who are being manipulated by some people or whose thoughts are being influenced, let's be more, tone it down a little, whose thoughts are being influenced by people who have a very nefarious political agenda, who are trying to make Islam, present Islam as a religion that advocates permanent warfare with the infidels so that Muslims become sort of the new communists. So we become the justification for these huge defense budgets. We become the scapegoat that failed policies can hide behind, or the advocates and architects of failed policies can hide behind. And so I think we as Muslims should work to eliminate those arguments so that people can see things for what they are.
We were wondering whether there are any people you have got in mind you would like to read your book or your contribution in the book.
I think, as I said, I think that Muslims who believe that there's only one way to look at the tradition, and that's the way that is presented by some contemporary quote-unquote radical groups, to see that there's another way to read the tradition and understand it, and that is more compatible with our situation. So if Muslims were America, we could say we gotta fight everybody. But we're on the receiving end of the damage. And when all is said and done, a militant can pack up and move on to the next country. But the people are left behind to deal with the depleted uranium, left behind to deal with the destroyed and devastated infrastructure, left behind to deal with the raw sewage that you now have to cook your food in, etc. Those people can't pack up and leave. And, you know, that being the case, we really have to, like, back away from the insanity of this escalating cycle of violence. Because as Muslims, if we're saying, oh, we have to fight until every Muslim, or a non-Muslim, we have to fight until we die and our company stock goes through the roof, or we sell so many weapon systems at the next arms fair, it's insanity, because the means, our means collectively as human beings of killing each other, becoming increasingly devastating, increasingly effective. So if there's constant escalation and no one backs away from this, it's insanity that serves no viable religious, moral, or ethical purpose.
You spent many years studying in the Middle East. How well do you think the Middle East understands the West?
I don't think the Middle East has anything to do with it, because maps don't tend to understand. But I think there are people in the Middle East and groups that don't understand the West very well at all. And reasons for that are the lack of balanced information. A lot of the presses in the Middle East are state-controlled. Probably the greatest source of information about the West, about what's going on in Israel, the West Bank, is the Israeli press, ironically. Not only that, but there are no centers. There's no major Middle Eastern university which has an Occidental studies department. In the West, we have Oriental studies, we have Middle East studies, Near East studies. There's no American studies department in any major Middle Eastern university. So at high levels, at the mass level, because of the narrow and controlled nature of the press, at the high level in terms of academia, you just don't have the wherewithal that's necessary to engender or bring about a deep, very sophisticated understanding of the West. And as a result, people are moved during these times of conflict to believe that they're out to get us, and that they are everyone out there in the West, and they're unable to discriminate or understand the sources of certain policies, to understand who potential allies are, etc. So as a result, there's a tendency to send back a message that only strengthens the hand of those antagonistic forces. They're out to get us, so we have to have jihad. And as a result, they take that and say, look, they're saying we need jihad, so we have to defend ourselves. Order more bombs.
Can an American involvement in the Muslim world be a positive one?
Definitely. Different people had a greater say in foreign policy. I think because of the diverse nature of the Muslim community in America, you could have, really, America could be, and using the Muslim community, could be out of goodwill, constructive developmental programs, constructive relationships with universities in the various Muslim countries, student exchange programs, meaningful aid programs that aren't tied to a political agenda, a host of things. But I think as long as this policy of antagonism and demonization is prevalent, that those things you won't see happening.
What do you think are significant steps the Muslim world can take to transport the ancient wisdom of the Quran into the modern world?
I think that there has to be a return to the spirit of the Quran that here in the West, as I understood the question earlier, the secular West, the materialistic West, quote unquote. There are a lot of stresses on the human psyche and the human soul, and there are a lot of teachings in classical Islamic spirituality that could help people to deal with those stresses, to alleviate those stresses, to develop an understanding of reality that's more integrated with the nature of that reality. But I think that idea is missed because many Muslims themselves have been influenced by the materialism, by the consumerism that has spread to those countries and have, as a result, been moved away from the spiritual emphasis that the Quran gives. So I think, as the Arabs say, the one. So I think if you had a revival of spiritualism within the Muslim world, that could be made. Also, another is very important, and that is created a brotherhood, Islamic brotherhood, transracial and ethnic barriers in many instances, not in all cases, but in many instances, I think probably more so in the United States than here. And that could be a very powerful contribution that Islam could make to the West, because here in these Western societies, racism is still a big issue. Periodically, the riots that occurred here a couple summers ago in the United States, certain trials or incidents that happen, they play themselves out along racial lines. So that indicates that still racism, the rise of fascist parties here in Europe, in the United States, indicate that these societies still have not gotten beyond the racial tensions that have kind of characterized them for a long time. So I think Islam can present a scheme that can encourage greater cooperation between races, minimalize the differences that exist between people, because these are teachings that are an integral part of Islam, and you see them actually lived out in many instances, not in all, but in many instances.
In the essay you contributed to the Crescent, you deal with the thesis dealing with jihad as perpetual war. Could you kind of summarize what the general ideas are?
The general idea is that Islamic teachings do present certain instances where Muslims are permitted to fight, physically fight. So it's not a pacifist religion. However, there are well-defined rules of engagement that prohibit, for example, killing civilians, that prohibit initiating hostilities in the dominant understanding where there is no transgression, that prohibit fighting if the ratio of force will, or in all likelihood, lead to greater harm accruing by fighting than by not fighting. Greater oppression will ensue, or greater harm will afflict the community. So there are a wide array of teachings that emphasize, that encourage Muslims to live peacefully with those who are at peace with them. So it's not a religion where there's a constant, unmitigating confrontation between Muslims and non-Muslims. And history bears out the soundness of this analysis. Muslims have, for long and extended periods of times in different parts of the world, lived at peace with their neighbors, and were it an imperative for them to fight, I think you have seen a lot more violence and bloodshed between Muslims and their neighbors. So, and in the contemporary context, I think the nation-state context, there are Islamic teachings that allow Muslims to live in this arrangement where peace is now the dominant, predominant reality existing in the relations between states. So most Muslim countries have accepted this arrangement and have been at peace with each other and with the non-Muslim neighboring states. So war is still, it occurs, there's no doubt, but it is an anomalous situation, And Islam deals with it as an anomaly, not as the dominant situation, especially at this juncture in history.
Are there books or projects you're involved in that we can look forward to in the future?
Right, there are two. One is a book along the lines of this particular article that I've written, where some other issues, contemporary issues, that form the basis of misunderstanding between Muslims and non-Muslims, I'd like to deal with. So maybe select nine other issues such as this, that Muslims will inevitably fight non-Muslims. So a lot of these other hot topics, this fall I'm working on a book that deals with, as I said, approximately 10 of these, this being one. This article will be part of that book. And another book is a translation of a text by Al-Harith al-Muhasibi, dealing with Islamic spirituality. And he was one of the first living
at the beginning of the third Islamic century to write formally in these matters. So his works are very early. They're the earliest, probably the earliest extant works that we have in this area. So I'm translating one of those from English, Arabic into English, and plan to provide extensive commentary.